Welcome to the Building Science Podcast.
Bringing the human factor to architecture and design.
Brought to you by Positive Energy in Austin, Texas.
Okay. Hello and welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the Building Science Podcast. I'm Christar Ferwin, here today with Josh Salinger. Josh is the founder and CEO of Bird's Mouth Design Build in Portland, Oregon. Bird's Mouth is a residential design build firm focused on addressing climate change through the built environment, through zero energy new homes and deep energy retrofits. He's an instructor for both Earth Advantage Sustainable Homes Professional Program and FIAS's Certified Passive House Builder Training Program. He sits on the board of Passive House Northwest and also sits on the technical committee of Zero Energy Ready Oregon. Additionally, he's an EBA Zero Energy Home Professional and an expert member on GBA, Green Building Advisor, and contributes content to Fine Home Building Magazine. He's also a dear man and a good friend. I'm really grateful to have your time, have you on the show. Josh, do you have any more introduction you'd like to offer?
No, I think you did a great job. Other than I'd like to say I've just enjoyed your podcast from the beginning, so it's an honor to be on it with you.
Yeah, thank you. And listeners, today Josh and I are going to have a conversation that's somewhat of a retrospective on his career leading to where he is now, and that is where we want to dig in, is you hearing a story hopefully you can identify with in some ways. And we want to touch into this space where we all find ourselves. Whether you know it or not, listeners, you are the self-selected group that's on the leading edge of rethinking how society thinks about and delivers housing to itself, indoor space to itself. So with that, let's jump in, Josh. Let's talk a little about your backstory, your genesis. How did you get started?
Yeah, well, I'm originally from Wisconsin, and I had a dad who had a really stressful white-collar job, and we had a weekend house we go to in northern Wisconsin on a lake, and his idea of blowing off steam was to build things. And so he'd build a deck, he'd redo our basement, you know, he'd be out there going to the local lumber yard, talking to the folks there, picking up new tools. He just loved to blow off steam doing that. And as a kid, I'm hanging around with dad, right? I mean, it was great. I loved playing with these things. He got his first sliding compound miter saw, and I must have been 10 years old, and he let me use it. You know, I mean, it was just awesome, right? Building stairs and decks and whatever. It was great. So I kind of, you know, engendered my love of craft, you know, with my dad. And so life goes on, and I ended up going to University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I got a degree in conservation and ecology. So I've always had this ethic around sustainability, and I don't really know where that comes from. That's not something my dad really did, but it's just been within me. And so I ended up pursuing that in college and came out of that, traveled around for a while, bounced around this and that, couldn't really find much work in that particular field, and found myself living in Portland, Oregon, bartending, just spanning the time. And ended up, a bunch of the roommates I was living with were carpenters. And so they brought all their tools in. And I was like, oh my God, I love this stuff. Like when I was a kid, I used to do this. And a bunch of these folks ended up working for a company in town here called Hammer and Hand.
Oh my goodness.
Do you know them?
Oh yeah.
They were one of the early passive house, you know, they were on the vanguard in the early days of just really bringing passive house and high performance building into our industry. And so I had the, you know, the good fortune to just randomly have these roommates that were working there. So while I was bartending, I would end up like telling people about all these tools and things that I was building and living with these guys that were doing this cool, you know, we called it green building back then. And, you know, eventually that kind of grew into like, oh, would you build a deck for me? Sure. You know, would you build a fence? Sure. So I started with little things like that. And next thing you know, it turned into, would you do a, you know, fourplex, you know, renovation for our condo, you know, just people I'm meeting at the bar. And that's when it got serious, right? And I was like, okay, well, I don't intend to be bartending for the rest of my life. And here's this opportunity to kind of take my my ethics around sustainability and apply it to my love of craft that I had growing up with my father and put those things together in a way that I could make a living. I was expecting my first kid, my daughter, right about that time.
Oh, my goodness.
And so it was important to find a way to like make a living. And I always, you know, wanted to have some sort of mission behind what I was doing. And it just seemed like this perfect, like the chocolate fell in the peanut butter with this opportunity to, you know, start a company where I could do green building, right? And so, you know, it started out in the very early days as just kind of low VOC paints and using reclaimed wood, and it's all wonderful stuff. But I remember early days, Portland, Oregon, the city sponsored a green building tour. And I ended up going on this tour, and I visited this house by a guy named Rob Hawthorne. His company was called PDX Living. And he was one of the first people to go to the Passive House training with Katrin Klingenberg in Chicago. And so he was building this Passive House here in Portland, Oregon around 2010. And it just opened my mind up. You know, I have a bachelor's of science. I have a science thinking brain. And, you know, and here is a way that they could actually take a building and really make an impact to that operational energy based on science, right?
Yeah.
And so that really changed for me to go from like the, you know, the low VOC paints and cellulose insulation. This is all good stuff and we're still promoting it. But then to move into this kind of science-based, smart type of building that was focused on the operational energy, right? And so I really ended up diving deep into the whole Passive House realm and slowly moved our company in that direction.
Fantastic.
So that's kind of how we came into being. You know,
I got a question related. Well, I mean, first let's give some shout outs and some thank yous, because your bird's mouth through you is a force in society right now in the community. So thank you to Dad. Thanks to Sam Hagerman and all the guys at Hammer in Hand. Glad your daughter came along when you did. And let's hear it for Passive House. Thanks for science. Science works.
Yeah.
And I have a comment and a question. So the comment is, I don't think people fully realize, like, when you're building a house for a client, that house ends up being infrastructure for society, right? It gets served by all kinds of services, but let's just say energy, electricity, and gas. And how you build the house is directly related to the carrying capacity, the effort, let's say, that society has to put into it. And I see that when I look at, I just turn my head and look, we're in Austin, downtown, near downtown, glass skyscrapers. And when it's 110 out, it's like, yikes. So that's my comment.
Yeah.
The question is, so why didn't you just send these jobs to Sam and you see if he could pick you up and you worked for Hammer in Hand?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess I'll tell this little story. I had gotten a job offer from Hammer in Hand.
Ooh.
And around the same time, I was thinking about starting my own business. And so we have this intersection here in Portland, Oregon, 39th and Hawthorne. And it's always like, okay, I don't know if there's some weird energy or, you know, don't know what's going on right there. But there's always some weird of something or other happening in that corner. And so I was waiting for a light and my phone rings and it's a friend. And he says, you know, we were talking last night. I think you should start your own business. And I was like, oh, thank you for that, you know. And then the light turns green. My phone rings again. And it's a completely different acquaintance calling up, saying, you know, out of the blue, I was just thinking you should start your own business. I was like, well, that's
weird. Oh, come on, Josh.
No, this is a true story. And then this is the third part. My wife calls and she's like, I think you should start the business thing. And I was like, are you kidding me? And
oh,
so I was like,
God,
this is just,
I'm going to get on a plane and go to that intersection.
Yeah. I mean, usually it's just some weirdo talking to himself, but you know, this particular time, you know, the universe spoke. And so I was like, okay, you know, I think I'm going to start my own thing, you know, and hang up my own shingle.
That's incredible. That is incredible. And I just want to tell listeners, like, I didn't know that when I asked the question. And I had a similar thing, it's a longer story, but, you know, I had a job in high energy physics. I was chief engineer to a research group, and I did not love it and eventually pivoted and started building houses out of that job. And my family was like, you're doing what? And it was similar. I'll just leave it at that for now. If anyone sees me, you know, over a drink, we can talk about that one.
Yeah, I like how we're having this conversation on a science podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Well, let's just say, you know, science is pretty clear now that we can only detect about a half to a third of what we call reality.
Right. We don't know what we don't know.
So the hooks were working with tools, going back to sort of family of origin issues, but also this true commitment to sustainability, true commitment to conservation and ecology. And I wonder, like, when you say ecology, I think of systems, right? Building science is systems thinking applied to homes. And you were well rooted in systems thinking applied to larger, right? Larger systems.
Yeah, well, I think that's why it spoke to me so much, right? Because I, you know, I'd always kind of thought about it that way. And a lot of your recent thinking on like emergy and exergy and all that kind of stuff, and thinking about like Donella Meadows and systems thinking and all that stuff, just really kind of closes that circle. But I think whether I knew it or not, you know, buildings very much are systems, not just within, it depends where you draw the boundary, certainly around the house, but like you were saying, around our communities or around society, right? And buildings play like a really big part in that. And I think I understood that on some level. I don't know if it was explicit or not, but I've certainly come around to that thinking where it's like, oh, this actually, with my background in ecology and thinking in systems like that, really makes, you know, an impact in the built environment, for sure.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're back at 39th and Hawthorne. If you got those three phone calls, what did you do next? And I guess you also were getting over the bar. You were getting people saying, hey, could you fix up my house or build me this quadplex or something? Renovate a quadplex.
Yeah. You know, I'm into the passive house thing and constantly talking about it, going to all the events and whatever, and trying to find our first building like this. And so I think it was around 2012, 2013, we ended up building our first zero energy home. And so, you know, I've always kind of enjoyed being at the cutting edge of things. I've always found that to just be more interesting. And so around that time, Albert Rooks at Small Planet Supply had started bringing in thermocork insulation. It was kind of like all the rage in our little circles, right? Everyone's clucking about thermocork. And so I found this great client who was Swedish, and he was, you know, used to the triple pane tilt turn windows and the ventilation systems and all this stuff. And he wanted to build a house, and we struck up a partnership and ended up using that thermocork insulation and zip system back in 2012, which was, you know, pretty early on with that stuff. Yeah. And everyone thought we had three eyes, you know, when we're putting cork on the outside of a building, right? I just, no one had seen this before. Certainly it was common enough and been used in the past. One of the interesting things about cork insulation is that it's one of the oldest insulations. People ask, like, well, does it have any like track record? And it's like, well, as a matter of fact, the refrigeration in the White House is insulated with cork. There are buildings in Portugal that have been around for 300 years that have used cork. So, you know, much longer than fiberglass insulation, right? So,
yeah, the petrochemical age has shifted our paradigms, let's just say.
Yeah. So, you know, with this project, you know, we had a Zender in there. It was all electric. You know, I used to, take baths every night, and that's when I get a lot of my thinking done. And I remember back in those days, I was always trying to think about like different wall assemblies and came up with an idea, which turns out it was kind of like, was a convergent evolution where two people come up with two ideas that kind of like, you know, end up at the same place. But I didn't come up with the idea, but I somehow independently came up with the idea of, you know, kind of bringing your sheathing up and over your roof rafters, right? So it's a 2x12 roof rafter filled full of cellulose insulation.
Oh my God.
And it's got zip system on top, which is your air barrier and your vapor control layer. And then we just put 2x6s over the top of that to create the eaves. And then we filled that with rock wool, about 3.5 inches, which left a ventilation gap up above it. And so it was kind of like, nowadays this is referred to as monopoly framing.
Perfect wall's a little different. It's inside.
Similar, right? Where it's got the exterior insulation to the outside of the
perfect wall would apply brackets for the overhangs. Yeah.
You know, I was just always trying to think of new ways to do things. And I think part of the reason why I always felt comfortable trying something completely different was that I didn't come up in the building industry, right? I didn't have that, well, this is how we've always done it this way for 30 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I came at it from more of a science-based thinking where I could look at something and say, well, that just makes sense, right? Like, clearly that is the least permeable part of the assembly right there. And if we insulate that with a vapor open insulation and we vent it, well, then it just works, right? Like, I'm not going to worry about this too much. Like, yeah, no one's really ever done this before in this town, or no one's really seen it before, but I'm not afraid to give it a go because it just makes sense, right? I'm going to butcher this quote, but it's Václav Havel, the old Czech president. He said, like, the reason you can have hope, paraphrasing, is because you know that it makes sense, right? If you know something makes sense, there's a reason for hope. And so I was similar like that, where I was like, I was willing to give things a try because I just knew from a science perspective that they made sense.
Oh, dude, beautiful.
Along those lines, like along with the Passive House and discovering Building Science Corporation, it was the first time that I was actually getting real answers to questions I had about assemblies or industry. Like, why are we using this black felt on our buildings, right? Ostensibly, it's to keep water out, right? It's the weather-resistant barrier. But you start asking questions, and no one could really answer it, like, satisfactorily. You know, like, I could never quite get a real good answer. And then you end up at these places like Building Science Corporation or FIAS, and they're like, oh, well, the reason we use felt paper is because that was a wind stop. Because back in the plains, back in the day, you would just take your framing and you would then put your clapboards over the top of it, and the wind would whip through it. It was highly uncomfortable. So they ended up using this stuff as like a windbreak. And so it's like an early form of an air barrier, right? And that's an interesting story, but like it just illustrates, like, for the first time, I was able to get answers to things. Or another answer they might give would be, I don't know. That's interesting. We should look into that, which is a perfectly good answer, right? As opposed to, well, we've always done it that way, or, you know, I've been doing it this way for 30 years. So that was another reason, like, that this type of building just made sense to me. And I was able to operate kind of on the frontier of our industry and try new things because I had that, you know, that hope or that knowledge to try different things and know that I wasn't going to fail, you know, or minimize the risk anyways.
Yeah. And yet there's, I mean, one thing you haven't talked about that's implicit in what everything you've just said about your origin story there is you have the entrepreneurial spirit, which includes an element of taking a leap. It includes some inner trust, some inner resolve to live your values come what may. And come what may could be some really shake your foundations kind of stuff. Yeah. Any thoughts about that?
Well, I think what I will add to that and say, like, back to my dad, right? He had a white collar job. So I came from a family that was pretty well off. And I don't think I could have done what I have done if I didn't know that I could fail and fall back. You know, there was that privilege that I had to be able to do that. Not everyone can just decide to try something completely new and completely fail at it. Because I knew that I would, you know, in my heart of hearts, if everything blew up, I would still have food on the table. Right. I knew that it would be okay. So that's just something I wanted to add to that.
Yeah. I feel like that was you being vulnerable just then. So thank you. And it's true. And it's also true that millions of other people had those, you know, same causes and conditions and took a more cautious approach through their work career. Or it's not just cautious. It's somehow we feel like what's going to make us really glad to be alive is just to constantly think about ourselves. Like, this idea of self-obsession applied properly will make us happy. And in fact, living with a sense of meaning and purpose is really usually what works. So you looked into that early on. All right, I want to move in. You mentioned a wall assembly. It's interesting how the icon of building science is the wall section, right? And you and I both have spent probably thousands, at least hundreds of hours looking at them, thinking about them, building them, thinking of
bar
new
napkins,
ways.
sketching.
Yep, exactly. Yep. Can you remember your first wall assembly? I guess your first ones were retrofits, right?
Yeah, we started, you know, I would call it just renovations, right? We were just really remodeling. And, you know, people would call, we do a kitchen, we do bathrooms, you know, that's kind of where we started, right?
Still a big need.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, like, I was going to talk about this at some point, but maybe this is a nice segue.
Do it. I can remember walls.
Yeah, well, we can come back to the walls for sure. But we had moved into mostly just building new homes. And, you know, the core mission of our company is to address climate change through the built environment. And we're looking around and saying, well, and we had spent years not growing in number of employees or size of projects or dollars made, but what we called a growth through values strategy. So we would try to, you know, grow, make our work more environmentally sensitive, or we would try to save more energy, or we would try to have better relationships with our clients, or we would try to, you know, create better work environment and culture for our staff. And so we had this growth through values, not through numbers of projects or whatever else. And we did that for years. But then as part of our mission, trying to address climate change through the built environment, we realized that we have to deal with the existing buildings that are out there. We can't build our way out of this problem. And so we agreed in one of our strategic meetings that we have once a year with kind of the management at our team that if we're serious about our mission, that we really need to take on retrofits and really try to decarbonize the existing buildings that are out there. And so, you know, when people would then call us and say, hey, we'd like to do a kitchen, we would say, well, okay, we're like a remodeling company with an energy efficiency problem, right? If you want to say it that way. But if you're willing to replace your gas furnace and your gas stove and your gas water heater with a heat pump and an induction range and a heat pump hot water heater, then we'd be happy and deal with your air tightness and insulation as best we can. Then we'd be happy to take on your kitchen project. And we really thought that would lead to some really awkward pauses on the phone, you know, and just people kind of hanging up. But interestingly, we found that more often than not, people would be like, wow, that's really interesting. I've always wanted to do that. I didn't realize that I could do that. Let's talk. And it's really kind of grown into a robust part of our company right now. So yeah, we have that retrofit part of our company that's doing quite well, trying to.
Boy, dude, you just shredded the plan I had to lead us through this. Because I, you know, talking about culture, talking about workplace culture, talking about the larger culture. And actually, I'm not going to go into it. I'm going to stay relatively on track. But I do want to make it clear that we exist in a capitalistic, materialistic society. And those ideas are everywhere. And we all use those to vet ideas. Like, is this going to work? Is that going to work? And what you did was, you kind of upped it a little bit and you were like, I wonder if people will like this. And they did. And it reminds me of like how EVs, electric vehicles, are entering our society right now. And they are not limited currently by anything other than availability, right? So like the people that said, oh, well, you know, and you know, I'm not going to name names, right? Certain auto manufacturers that weren't Tesla were saying, well, there's just no demand. There's just, you know, we don't see good demand, predict good demand for them. So we're not going to offer them. When in fact, what was happening was because you're not offering them, they're not being purchased, you know, because they can't be. And as soon as you offer them, so what I'm saying is for you and everyone listening, please don't believe all of your thoughts around what's possible right now, because chances are good that you could up your game in many ways and the society that you sell to would receive it and say, yes, I've actually wanted that. Actually, finish your story. Maybe is that what happened?
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. And I would encourage people to do that because, you know, I think we've been as successful as we have because we have been true to our mission and our values. And we've said no to things and said, well, this is just what we do, right? And it's been nothing but good news for us. And I think you're right. I mean, I think part of the problem was like we just weren't asking. Do you realize that you could also do this as part of your renovation and you can make an impact? I mean, you know this, but you know, 40% of all the greenhouse gas emissions on the globe come from our buildings. And if we want to make the biggest impact we can as individuals, we can do it in our homes and in our buildings. And a lot of people want to hear that, right? And so when you mention this to them, they find that to be attractive, and they, you know, that grew some of our business, you know. I think another thing too is, like, we're talking about energy efficiency now, but energy efficiency is a happy side effect of things that people want in their buildings in the first place, which everybody wants a durable building, right? Like, you can build a zero energy building. Any knucklehead can build a zero energy building, but try to do it so it doesn't rot or fall down or have bacteria, mold issues and things like that, right? Try to do it so that it's healthy, right? Like, people want healthy buildings.
Yep.
These are the things that people want that don't, they go unsaid. It's like, it's so intrinsic to the idea of a building that people don't even say it. But I think we need to start saying it. Like, people want durable buildings. That, and if you have a durable building, it doesn't have rot, which makes it healthy, right? And people want to have buildings that are resilient, right? They want to have a building that during a cold snap, their pipes won't freeze and cause all sorts of economic damage. They want it survivable. They want to know that their elderly parent is going to be okay during that heat dome event, which is becoming more and more common, right? People want buildings that are comfortable. And if a building is comfortable, you don't walk over to the wall and start toggling the thermostat, which means it's more energy efficient too, right? So these things all cascade down, starting with durability and health and resiliency and comfort. And if you, those are the things, like I said, that usually go unsaid. And if you deliver those to people, you end up with energy efficiency anyways. And so I think our job at our company is to try to figure out when someone's calling and asking us that, you know, they've got a project, is where are they in that spectrum, right? Are they, do they want a building that's going to last that they can give to their grandkids, right? Or their great grandkids? Are they someone that has health issues and they want to, you know, make a, you know, they have my son has allergies, right? Like, I would love to live in a building that is airtight and has filtered fresh air in it, right? Environmental sensitivity, stuff like that. Are you someone that wants to, you know, we just in Portland, Oregon, a week and a half ago had an ice storm and the power went out all over the city. And so this conversation was just top of mind, and resiliency is becoming like a really big important thing. And so, you know, we want to figure out whoever's calling, like, what is your avatar? Where are you calling from? Where can I meet you? And, you know, apply this stuff to the building so that we end up with something that is energy efficient and supports our values and our mission at our company. And we lead people towards this because it's what they want anyways, right? It's just kind of trying to figure out that narrative, that story, to get people to click, right? And go, oh, that's what I want. You know, thank you for mentioning this.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Yeah. So I realize, what you're delivering to people isn't just their renovation or their retrofit or their new home. You're also starting out by delivering information, delivering perspective, delivering values, not just value, but values. So I know where I want to take this, but I want to just interject with another 40% that I read about recently. 40% of all maritime cargo, keep in mind, maritime cargo is using a lot of our fuels. 40% of their cargo is fuels. So as soon as we start really to electrify, well, boom, 40% of all the cargo that would have been on a ship doesn't need to be on a ship, right? So what I'm saying is, like, that's a perspective to give people. Like, you know, we're about to see an acceleration of change. You know, there's all this kind of what I consider fear mongering, you know, and maybe PR-based fear-mongering around the climate crisis, like it's too late and there's all these positive feedback loops that are going to, you know, the tundra is going to accelerate the melting. And some of it's quite legit. But the point is that with regard to houses, 40% of the energy is coming from houses. To the extent we electrify them, we also hasten really positive benefits to start rippling through our society, through our homes. Not to mention probably the most important thing that I think you just mentioned is that you're providing an education to your clients along with the result of your work. And that education is like the ripple, and you drop the pebble in the pond and the ripples go out through their family, network, friends, coworkers. And it starts everywhere.
Yeah. Have you seen Zach Zemke's putting the punk in Passive House?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Series I was there when he rolled it out.
Okay. I love what he's talking about there, because he's like, as humans, we can hold like really bad things, right, in our minds at the same time that really positive things are happening. And I always try to remember this, like whenever you hear those kind of those stories, those, you know, the climate doom stories, there's incredible advancements in thinking and technologies that are coming up that are on this like, you know, exponential curve upwards at the same time. We need to like be able to hold these two things in our brains. We can do this, right, at the same time and not get dragged down, right? It's like the word ambivalent, right? It's like ambivalent doesn't mean that you're agnostic. It means like you're holding two opposing things in your mind at the same time, right? There's a word for this, right?
And yeah, absolutely.
It's in our lexicon. It's very common, right? And we should be able to do this, right? And so, and you know, what's the, it's an old quote, like, you know, even if the world was ending tomorrow, I would still plant my apple tree.
Or what about a sequoia?
Or a sequoia. Yeah, exactly. And because the idea is like, you're going to be doing got to keep this positivity in mind and know that I'm doing the right thing. And that doesn't mean righteousness. You know, it doesn't mean that like I am righteous and I'm doing the right thing. It means to do the best you can.
And it doesn't mean denial either.
Right, right. And apply that to your life and what you do. And, you know, to your point, people see that, right? Like, and they get behind that. And it tends to foster innovation and growth and positivity.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like it's worked for you. Let's get back to that lowly wall. So you were in your bathtub and you thought of the Monopoly House wall. You implemented it because you also had a network of peers that you could turn to. I mean, if I'm remembering right, some of the early Hammer and Hand folks were people like Dan Whitmore and Scatter Swinford.
Yeah.
And many others. So did you build it first and then see if they thought it was a good idea? How did that go? Did you think of it, talk to friends, then build it?
Oh, you know, I mean, you there's the community that you lean upon, right? I mean, we would just talk about this stuff. I mean, to this day, I have some, you know, text thread going with Skylar Swinford, like about, you know, currently it's about like the, you know, where electrons come from in your grid and how that affects like, you know, operational energy versus like the embodied carbon.
Absolutely.
And you know, but point being is like, you're absolutely right. Like there was people that I was bouncing these ideas off of and we would get together and it was those heady early days, you know, 12, 15 years ago where wall assemblies were this origami of multiple layers and thick walls and you know, it was great. Like we just loved thinking about this stuff and coming up with ideas and bouncing it off of one another. And yeah, absolutely had those networks and fortunate that here in Portland, Oregon, we had Sam Hagerman and Dan Whitmore. And I'm thinking of Scott Gunter he built some of their early Passive House projects and certainly Skylar and Zach Semke used to work at Hammer and Hand back in those days.
That's
he was
right.
Part of that group. So yeah, I mean that original core group right there really was a great, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to have them at my disposal to, you know, grab a beer, draw on those napkins and just, you know, spitball ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. So we could all like take a moment and thank Sam Hagerman and
Daniel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sam and
for
Daniel.
What they did and what the ripples that are still flowing. So the walls, like the easy part of the wall is the section. The hard part of the wall are the holes. You know, so window flashings, I'm thinking of air tightness. I'm thinking of moisture management. Do you have any, like, were you always successful with your walls? Do you have any issues with walls?
You know, as far as I know, the walls that we've built and the homes that we've done are doing quite well. I think what we've been able to do over time is just make them more efficient you know, kind of lighten them up a little bit and make them easier to produce, more cost effective, as opposed to some of those early ones. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's the punched openings, the windows and doors, the, you know, the mechanical penetrations, the electrical, all that stuff that, you know, the where walls come together in the corner or they meet a foundation or a roof. It's all those spots that you got to, that's where your attention gets focused. It's not necessarily the big open plane of the wall that is the difficult part.
That's right.
So I think a lot of that, you know, we've dealt with just process, right? And just trying to, you know, do similar, you know, not the same, but for mostly similar styles of walls, right? So for our company, we've really landed on exterior insulation. So for us, our typical wall is a 2x6 wall. You have your sheathing, which is your vapor control layer. It's your air barrier. You tape the sheathing at that point, or you use a self-adhered membrane, depending on stuff. Then you have exterior insulation. You have a rain screen gap. You have your siding, cladding, flashings, and so on and so forth. And any of those things can change a little bit based upon the inputs that any particular climate client or site might throw at you, right? So for instance, the last house we built, the previous house had burnt down due to the wildfires. And so it was really important for that client to have a Class A rated exterior insulation wall assembly. So that was what was driving the decisions in that wall assembly. So we ended up, this was during when we were designing this house, was during the late part of the pandemic, and one couldn't get rock wool, and rock wool is one of the Class A fire rated materials. And so the only other at the time Class A fire rated material was cork. And so we ended up using cork. And so that's what made us decide upon that particular exterior insulation. Another project we did was for a retiring couple. They were professors in Eastern Oregon University, moving out west to retire. They didn't have a lot of money, but they wanted passive house and they wanted the benefits of the indoor air quality and all that. And for them, budget was driving, right? So the first example is fire. And this one was budget. And so we ended up using a GPS insulation to the exterior of that building and zip system sheathing because it was cheaper than plywood and self-adhered membrane or liquid applied. Certainly the GPS was cheaper than all the other types of insulation that were available. And so we made that wall work, right? We had to make sure that our exterior insulation was now thick enough because it was more vapor closed than something like a cork or a rock wall, that we wouldn't get condensation on that sheathing, on the inside part of that sheathing. And so that's what drove the decisions in that one. You know, you could, it could be orientation. It could be if you're on the north side of a mountain in a forest of fir trees versus, you know, a perfectly flat site that's got the opportunity to orient your building, right? That could affect the thickness of your exterior insulation. You could have a client that's really interested in embodied carbon. And so that one would not be a good choice for like the foam-based products or the rock wool.
GPS would be bad.
And yeah, so that client would probably go towards something like a wood fiber exterior insulation. That was another recent project that we had where we used a wood fiber board for exterior insulation. And then, you know, things come into play. So if you're using a wood fiber board, well, where's your air barrier and where's your bulk water control layer? Well, with wood fiber board, there's a conversation that's happening out there about whether or not that makes a good long-term bulk water control layer. Also, can you leave wood fiber out without a WRB? Could you use it as a WRB? And we just circumvented the conversation. Smart people can have that conversation and agree to disagree about that. We simply said, well, we'll tape the sheathing for our air barrier, put the wood fiber to the outside, and then we'll just do a membrane of a WRB to the outside of that. So now we just took that conversation off the table.
Right.
And by doing that, we used ThermalBuck, which I thought is a really nice product in this particular application. And then we got flanged windows, which we hadn't used in a long time. But what it did is it allowed us to make our window install really simple. It was like the traditional, just cut it at the tops of the corners, flap it up. You know, nail your window in, seal it up, flap back down, and tape it back at the angles above the top of the window.
Yeah.
And so it made for a very cost-effective way to do it. So the point being is you have to be able to take the information, whatever's important to that client or budget or site or whatever it is, and then take our framework for a wall, which is a 2x6 with exterior insulation, and then modify that to fit. And that has become very efficient for us, right? Now, that might be different for you. You know, you're down in Austin, Texas. You're going to have different climate. You're going to have a lot more humidity to deal with. You're going to have latent mm-hmm. loads. You're going to have dehumidification. You're going to have issues that we don't have here in our little Goldilocks land here, Pacific Northwest. And it's going to look different for you than it does someone in St. Paul, Minnesota. Or, you know, maybe you've got a team that's really good at double stud walls.
Yeah.
That's great. You know, like, do you be you, right? And do what is efficient for you and do what works in your climate. Create a framework. Like, we do double stud walls. We do Larson trusses. We do exterior insulation. You know, whatever. Those things all can work great. Do what's efficient for you and then take that input of your client, climate, budget, whatever it is, and adjust your wall to fit those goals, those avatars that come at you, right? And that's what can make a really efficient, cost-effective way to build buildings that are, you know, again, durable, healthy, resilient, and comfortable, and then, by extension, energy efficient.
Thank you so much. That was such an important concept to lay out. I'm so glad we got that recorded. It also, I think there are people like holding their jaw, like, how on earth can you say it's efficient? Like, let's certainly say cost efficient to do something different based on site and climate and client value preference systems. When in fact, like I said earlier, we live in a, you know, capitalist materialist society. There's a whole term, like, you know, production builders. They are producing homes, and guess what their walls do from climate to climate? They don't change, right? And they're using many of them are using 1/8-inch thick fiberboard behind stone cladding. And so I guess you're talking within the custom home realm.
Yeah. We're talking about custom homes. We're talking about custom residential homes. But mm-hmm. I'd also argue you need to move that. You need to shift the temporal distance here, right?
Yep.
And say, okay, yes.
That's where I was hoping you'd take this. Yay.
You know, there is the first cost, you know, race to the bottom. Humans, no matter how much of a budget you have or how much, you know, you decide you want to do, we tend to push that as far as we can, right? That's just kind of what humans do. We're prone to biting off more than we could chew. So, you know, one of the first things humanity. Is just to, yeah, I mean, just try to be mindful of, like, you know, just, you don't need that much. Can we back it up a little bit and deliver a better building that might be a little bit smaller? Or, you know, that's, you know, what's the ROI of your marble backsplash, right? Like, no one asked that question, right? But back to the temporal thing, like, over time, these buildings are going to deliver value, right? And there's different ways to define value. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's value in the sense of monetary value, right?
Yeah.
And if we take that, if you have zero or near zero operating expenses on this building, and you're insulating yourself from future price increases of the cost of energy, that building typically over the course of a 30-year mortgage is going to end up being cheaper than what you would have spent on that additional energy and those energy increases, right? So that's one type of value. But there's other, I'm repeating myself, you know, intentionally here, right? Like, the other value it's bringing is durability. You can, you know, give this house to your, you know, your son or your daughter. You can, then your grandchildren could have it, so on and so forth, right? There's value to society because we are creating buildings that are offsetting the carbon at the source, right? Mm-hmm. There is value in the resiliency that these buildings bring. What good is a building if you got it for really cheap if all the pipes burst during a cold snap? Yeah. What good is that building? How much does that cost you, right? To go back to that type of value. Yeah. Or like if, you know, a couple of years back it got to 116 degrees with the heat dome here in Portland, Oregon. People died, right? these buildings can protect against that. So I think we need to expand our horizons of thinking temporally and in space, and realize that ultimately these things are a better value. And that is admittedly difficult when people try to build as much square footage or push themselves to that limit. And then, does it cost more to do that? First costs? Yes, right? It does. Like, it costs more to buy a Mercedes than it does to buy a 1972 Datsun. Like, you're getting more. They're both street legal, right? But you're getting more with the Mercedes, or maybe it's better to say the Hyundai Ioniq 5 or the electric vehicle. I think that's the paradigmatic shift that needs to happen, right? We need to change our thinking away from these efficiency first cost things and look at value. Absolutely. Because value means things to people, right?
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, and as we were talking about a little bit before the show, before we started recording, it's very clear to you and I, we have a broad perspective, we interact with a lot of different types of clients, that our clients appreciate the value of their homes. Sometimes they're just not clear when they're not getting it. And, everything we've just said, everything that's been on this podcast, generally listeners, is trying to say the same thing. Hey, society, building science and electrification, sustainability, it's offering you an upgrade in the quality of your experience of living in your home. And that upgrade, because we're in this consumer society, we're going to say, it's a material thing. The upgrades are material. And we're actually, GDP is what it's all about in our society. So it's not just material. It's about the material of money. It's a financial decision. And so everything needs to get ROI'd. And I love what you just said about the ROI of your backsplash. We're often saying, what's the ROI of your pillow or your bed? Right. But if you say you should put in a dehumidifier here in Austin, clients say, well, can you do some math and show me the ROI on that? It's like, well, it's a quality upgrade. But, what I really want to get to is that there's no way around it. This is an inexorable transition kind of forward. And, well, I guess you could argue that point. Do you think that there's a clear forward direction for the building industry? Just to ask you a hard question.
Yeah, I mean, I think, how can I put this? I mean, like, if you're trying to be good at your professional career and your career is in building, you have to look at what makes a better building. And mm-hmm. this just mm-hmm. is objectively delivers a better building from all of those, feedbacks. And so I don't know. I mean, is the question, like, is our industry wanting to move forward? And do better? Certainly parts of it are, a lot of the people you and I know and the work that's happening in the high performance mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. passive buildings. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me interject here. Please finish your thought. And I have a comment.
Oh, that was kind of the end of my thought. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. So I apologize for that. You alluded to earlier, smaller, better buildings, smaller, better homes, which is kind of like my mantra here. It's like, oh, I can't afford that. I'm like, well, your house is, 4,000 square feet, make it a little smaller and afford that. Simple logic. But getting into that word better, just sort of briefly, like, I'd like to unpack the word better. Better means you had a baseline and then you moved a direction, and based on some criteria, you've improved from the baseline. And I think one of the things that's happening is what's being measured, like what thoughtful architects, what thoughtful builders, what thoughtful trades, what thoughtful owners bring now is this clarity of, do you know what I get from this home? I get the experience of living in it. I get the experience of owning it. And that is what I want you to make better. And so that experience of owning it is, the weather forecast just said heat dome, and my belly didn't ratchet up into fear because I live in a passive house. Or the flip side, it just said power outages, and I have a passive enclosure, and I have electrochemical storage and thermal storage. So I just want to point out in that scenario, you didn't have to have the power failure nor the heat dome for the experience of ownership to be improved, to be better.
Yeah. What you're talking about is a story, right? Like, people respond to stories, not facts on paper, right? Like, I mean, I was just reading an article about, like, you know, you could point out that right now, like, crime is way down. The economy is doing really good. But people have this, like, you know, oh, everything's terrible, but, you know, I'm doing okay, but for everyone else, it's really bad. We are creatures of stories, right?
Yeah.
This is the Naval Harari kind of great book, Sapiens, and everything he's written is kind of about this. Like, we function based upon the stories that we're told. And what you just told was a story, right? About, like, the experience of this house is so much better, right? Like, I didn't, my stomach didn't get tied into knots when I looked at the weather forecast, right? We're telling a story, and we need to do that. And those stories are what changes the paradigm. Right now, the paradigm is like, oh, house, how can I, you know, it's a cost-based story, right? How can I get the most I can for the least amount of money is the story that we're telling ourselves around houses right now and buildings right now. We need to change that story into something akin to what you just said, right?
Yeah.
And then people will start asking for that. And we're starting to see that, you know, we get people calling our company and asking for healthy homes, or they're asking for something that'll last a long time. So it's starting to get out there, and we need to get these stories. We need to change that paradigm through these stories that we're telling.
I love it. All right. Let's leverage that and start to move toward our ending. The next step, you know, next storytelling step is that when you're living indoors, you're living immersed in a mass of air, and you're taking it in, you know, 12 times a minute, pint glass, 12 pints a minute into your every tissue and cell. So we're becoming, like, when you mentioned health and stories. And I got into this building industry in around the late 90s, and I didn't realize that when I joined it, it was in this period of tremendous change. So I just felt like, oh, I'm just learning this new stuff, and it's been there for a long time. I come to realize, you know, like, meeting people like Skylar and Zach and you all back then, it's like, oh, I'm actually learning at the edge of what the industry is learning. And I really didn't realize it. Just go to the conferences and say, oh, I've heard that one on window flashing. Let me, you know, see what's going on here. So the point is, a lot of people, a lot of professionals in the industry, a lot of people on the supplier side, you could argue even homeowners, we're all starting to be converged on, yeah, the importance of the enclosure is paramount. It is not everything. The enclosure is filled with air. It's this thousands of pounds of fluid, this compressible fluid that I actually live in. Everything else I live next to, and or above or below, but I live in the air. So let's start to pay attention to the air. And it's reasonable that we hadn't, because it's invisible and we live in it all the time. So I guess I'm trying to long way around ask you, when did you start to really let the other boot drop and start to think about mechanical systems or MEP systems more broadly?
Yeah, I think it was through frustration. We started originally as a just a contractor. We'd work for third-party architects, and we just got tired of having to, like, teach these architects, like, oh, let's talk about the wall assemblies. Let's talk about, you know, getting better windows. Let's talk about bringing in a ventilation system and all this stuff. And so finally we were like, you know what, let's just do this design in-house. And then once we started bringing it in-house, that's when we started having to think real hard about mechanical systems, or at least think of more harder about them, deeper about them.
Yeah.
And so we started asking questions, and we were just, again, getting unsatisfactory answers from a lot of our HVAC partners, right? Like, you know, why are we locating the return here? Why are we doing multiple heads off of one exterior compressor? I heard that that's not as efficient, and we just wouldn't get good answers to that.
Oh boy.
You know, why are you insisting on using this flex duct here? You know, like, have you thought about the sound mitigation of these things? Like, how many CFM are you delivering to each room, and where are you taking it from? And it just, we didn't get any good answers. We'd say, can you please do a manual J? And they're like, oh, we do it all on all of our projects. Well, can you show it to us? Well, we just use rule of thumb, I'm like, well, I'd like to see it, and then, well, that'll cost $500. I'm like, so anyways, we get it and you look at it and they just put the default values in there. And I'm like, well, can you change this to that? And so we were getting frustrated, just realizing like, you'd like to think that when you pick up a phone and you call a company that's got vans all over town and big billboards and they're the team out there, that they really know what they're doing and you could ask them questions and challenge them and they could engage in good conversation. But we just, it was remarkable to find out how little they knew about their craft. And we're like, really? You don't know these most basic things about heat pumps and delivery systems and even ventilation? Like, you realize there's a V in HVAC. That's, it should be, actually it should be VHAC, right? It's like the most important thing. Like, but you can't really articulate to me the reason why we should be delivering this fresh air. You could tell we got frustrated. And so we were just like, okay, we have to learn this ourselves. And we just ended up going deep, calling our partners, our network, and call the folks at Mitsubishi, and you go to the conferences and you dig in, you talk, oftentimes it's talking with like folks on your team, just at summer camp, talking to Hop or talking to whomever,
Yeah.
And just chewing on these ideas and digging deeper and deeper into it. And it really, you realize very quickly that like, oh, like there's not an adult out there that's going to come in and do this for you. You have to learn it. And I think that's something that a lot of architects and builders like need to understand, that they need to become experts, maybe not experts, but be conversant in HVAC so that they can engage with their partners and, come up with the best fit for the particular situation. And that's where we've really landed with this. It's just too important. It's just like after the enclosure, it is the mechanical system. And it used to be something you just phoned in.
Yeah, I'm so with you. And just getting personal for a minute, like listeners have heard this, like my caring for better buildings and taking care of clients' experiences sometimes manifests as like aggravated frustration, and a lot of negativity comes out of me. And I love that you called it remarkable. Because I was back in the early mid aughts, I was a building science consultant. That was my role. And there'd be a McLaren in the driveway and a turd in the mechanical house. I don't know the way to describe it. It was just terrible. It was intestinal ducts and the same, literally the same contractor that came out of the production homes had installed it. And it was like a 0.5% of construction cost for the whole HVAC system or the VHAC system. Or actually, no, it was just a HC system.
A hack.
Heating and cooling system. Yeah.
Sounds like a hack.
Well, even conditioning, even that word conditioning doesn't count unless you're filtering it and controlling humidity. But the point is, that this caring led to the business model that's positive energy. And then you start to realize, well, that's not enough. You and I build these machines that are ready to, this business being a machine ready to deliver services to society, and realize, why are there not a lot of people up taking what I'm offering? And you realize, oh, because they don't have perspective. So now we have a podcast. It's just this like recursion, bootstrapping.
Well, it's telling those stories, right? It's hard, right? Because you don't see it. Like you said before, like you just don't see it. You're like, well, I've always lived in a house that didn't have ventilation. Mm-hmm. I'm fine. Mm-hmm. How many people aren't fine because of it, right?
Right.
It's that extra level of tricky because you can't see it. It's not something that you can, it's not a badge. It doesn't have that, hey, look what I spent.
Right. Well, getting back to where the rubber meets the road here. So, you have vans all over town. You'd like to believe, there was an adult in the room and all that. And so we've developed, a handful, maybe a dozen or so decent and maybe a smaller of really good trades, and networks around the country in different markets. And so people like mechanical installers are starting to get it. They're really starting to pivot. Electricians are starting to understand electrification better. And what did you do? Did you like get your mechanical license and do all the work yourself for that? Did you convince a trade partner to change their practices? Yeah, how'd that go down?
Yeah, we worked with a trade partner. We used the worst HVAC contractor in town. They were just better than all the other ones, right? So we started with them and worked with them. You know, we invited them over. Like, and we'd always be like, well, we're doing this woofy model, and you did the manual J. These things aren't lining up. Like, come over to the office. Let's talk. And, you know, this particular owner of this company was engaged. You know, he really likes this stuff. And so, you know, he'd come over to the office and we'd get nerdy and just go deep into the numbers and try to figure out, like, what, why are we getting different results here? What is it? And try to come up. So I think what you need to do is find people that have that curiosity, right? That are willing to engage with the stuff. That's the secret, right? And if you get someone that just doesn't care, you're never going to get there with them, right? And that's what we had in terms of our HVAC, you know, contractor. But even then, you know, it was still oftentimes difficult to get within that trade partner, to get, like, the owner would engage with us and get it, but then whoever showed up on site didn't get the memo, right? So that's where we had to become experts in HVAC so that we could QC that. And then we realized, well, you know, maybe we need to do all the manual J's and manual D's and system specifications ourselves. But we're not totally experts at that. Like, I think we did okay, but it would take a lot of time. It wasn't what we did all the time. So we started just kind of subbing that out to mechanical engineers. This is a thought I've been having recently, is like, to build a house, you need a few things. You need a contractor, an architect, and a structural engineer, right? And why do you have a structural engineer? You have that so the house doesn't fall down, right? How come we don't require mechanical engineers just as much as we require structural engineers? Like, if we don't get the mechanical part right, you can create a really unhealthy building. You could create a building that rots and falls down, right? That's what your structural engineer does. Why aren't we requiring a mechanical? I mean, no one would build a commercial building without a mechanical engineer.
I'm shaking my head, by the way, you guys. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I did not set him up to ask this question. I want to be very clear. I did not say, please make sure.
I think
sure
it was
you...
rhetorical, but, you know, but for our own homes where we raise our children, like, this is just not something that we're paying attention to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And well, I mean, let me interject just to take it larger, right? So from back Hammurabi days, right? You know, yeah, the house can't fall down. And we decide, oh, the Romans, like, oh, we need potable water in the house. And we shouldn't, you know, we have, so as a society, no one blinks if you say, oh, we're going to have codes to make sure your water's, you know, not bad for you. And fire code, right? Of course, we're going to have structural code and fire code and sanitation code for water. Oh, and drainways, fence. But if you say to someone, there should be a code that the air in the house is healthy to breathe, you know, it's like, what? But that's the exact same paradigm. It's the exact same logic. In fact, your dominant environmental intake is indoor air breathed in your home. So you don't even have to clean up the whole world, just the air in your home. In fact, if you just want to even smaller, just clean up the air in your bedroom.
Yeah, well, you're moving it forward, right? I mean, if you take that long view of history, right? Our industry is moving forward, right? With all the sanitation codes, fire codes.
IAQ code, buddy.
This is the next one, right? But it's, you know, it's always tough to talk about.
What would that be? There's the IECC. It would be the IAQC, International Air Quality Code. Okay, so I think I don't want to dig in specifics on mechanicals. I actually want to get to the end. We've been at this a minute. And, you know, we can spend a few minutes here on the end. But so the kind of the answer is, let me just recap. So listeners, what I'm hoping you're hearing is you're hearing a thoughtful, engaged person who really is thinking about the future and is really thinking about bettering the society that he's working in. And I actually want to be really clear. I'm sure it's not just you, Josh. You've mentioned many times the leadership team and all your people at Bird's Mouth.
100%. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And here we are today, right? So he's had a career kind of riding the wave on the edge of what's possible and, you know, and trying to find what's reasonable and what's effective and how to tell stories to clients and trade partners. So with that as a basis, like, do you have any thoughts on what's next? Where are the levers for change or what's on your mind these days? Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of, I feel like with the building science stuff, we haven't solved it, but we've got 90%+ of the way there, you know, especially for us acutely, like we know what we're doing for our particular assemblies and our climate and things like that. So,
absolutely.
You know, I feel like that box has been checked, and that used to be such a fun, you know, thing to think about. It was interesting and diverse and like fun to let your brain chew on that. And I feel like, okay, well, that's what is next. And, you know, so we moved to retrofits, you know, embodied carbon. We've been doing a bunch of work with, you know, low carbon concrete, things like that, which is all interesting stuff. And we could have lots of conversations about just that alone. But I think where my thinking has been, like having always been at that kind of leading edge or trying to push the boundaries, is like, I think it's really trying to like change the narrative, right? And the stories and get those out there. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have a soapbox where I can have these thoughts and discussions and get it out there to people, whether that's through GBA or Fine Home Building or being able to teach the builder's training course and stuff like that. So I think for me, it's a lot about like, how can we refine our stories to get them to be attractive to the market? You know, I suppose the market, you know, the people that are looking to build buildings and also just the people that craft these buildings, right? So that story becomes something that they center and then creates that change.
Right.
And so I've been just trying to think of what is that, you know? And I think part of it is just getting out there and having these conversations. Like, you know, I don't profess to have all the solutions, but, you know, by any extent, but if I can at least, you know, engage in the conversations and bring up other people's ideas, or, you know, there's some intractable problem, can we just stare at it and like marinate on it and see what we can do? And those, it seems like that's happening in these conversations. And I think that's kind of where I've been kind of moving my thinking in our business, you know, trying to reach more people. You know, I'm sort of part of it's trying to make this more equitable and reachable for the, that's something I think about a lot too, is just like, we can build these homes that levitate for people that can afford it, right? But how do we get that down to, if we want to really impact change on a big level, we have to make these affordable to everybody. And so I think those are stories that are going to lead the manufacturers to create these products that we need locally. It's going to be training the trades to be able to implement these materials into buildings. It's going to be designers and architects understanding that the form of their building, those gerrymandered floor plans that they're putting out there, are just not leading to cost effectiveness or indoor air quality or health or durable, any of these things.
Right.
And we need to get these stories out there. I think your friend Corey Squire in his book has done a really nice job with that. And I think that's...
Definitely.
But if we get the manufacturers, the installers, the market asking for this, it's going to get cheaper and it's going to become more accessible for everybody. I mean, you go to Europe, you go to a Bauhaus, that's like the, you know, European version of a Home Depot, and they have tilt turn triple pane windows for sale for like $250. It's just what there is, right?
Yep.
It's not that it's more expensive or more difficult. It's just that it's changing from where we are now to get to where we need to go is going to be bumpy. And we have to help, you know, grease that way or whatever the saying is, you know, make that easier to get where we need to go. And I think
I didn't know what to expect, but that's not where I expected you to take your answer. I thought you were going to say, oh, more continuous insulation and ERVs with higher SHRs. And
yeah, I mean, those are important.
Yeah, I'm with you. And it's also true that, yeah, we as a human society, we need a lot more than just new materials. We need long range order to re-equilibrate. We need fundamental like remappings of the energy and flow and resource systems and the information flow systems that we avail ourselves of. In fact, the HOPE comment, and I'll bring it up here briefly, is, you know, at the time of this recording, it's like way before an election season, but it's already election season. And it's kind of disheartening. It's kind of challenges my sense of hope And I try to find myself, I think of myself as like mining for hope. Like I'm going to find a vein of it and I'm going to stick with it. And I start to realize that the media has turned into something like this massive hallucination machine, right? There's mainstream media and there's specialty media. I don't know what it's called, social media. But underlying all of it, you know, you could say on both sides, quote unquote, as though there are only two sides, which is not at all real. On every situation, humans want truth. They want to have decisions that are, they want to make decisions with a worldview that's based on reality. And I'm not saying that all my decisions or everything you hear on this podcast are based on reality. I am saying I would like to have agreement on what facts are and how we adjudicate what reality is. And I think it's also like a little clever saying that there's only one worldview that is truly reality based, right? I don't think I have it necessarily, but you know, by definition, reality is just one thing. The point is that hope is there because underlying all this hallucinations that we're all being exposed to, these manipulations and PR campaigns, underlying all of it, humans want the truth. They want the real stuff. And so that keeps me hopeful. And that's a story,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think that's the Vaclav Havel thing, right? I think you just articulated that, right? Like, it's how we can continue to move forward knowing that we're doing the right thing. We can wake up in the morning and deliver, you know, healthy buildings for our clients and their kids, right?
Who doesn't want a healthy, durable, efficient, you know, building that makes them feel safe, sheltered?
Yeah. I mean, look at the opposite. If you're not doing that, what are you doing?
Right.
You know, like stop and think about that. Like, I'm just going to deliver this thing so I can make a quick buck and to hell with the people that end up living there. I mean, that's a deeper problem. You know, like if you're a reasonable human that's trying to, you know, deliver excellence in one's life, in one's professional life, whatever it is, it just leads to this type of building. And the beauty is that, you know, if we do this, it leads to a better society. Right? A carbon-free or carbon sequestering society, one that allows us to have more oxygen instead of CO2 in our rooms, better, you know, health for our kids. They're not dealing with allergies. You know, it's through, you know, the impending changes that are coming with climate change to be able to make that survivable and kind of get rid of those peaks and knock them down a little bit, those valleys, like let's bring them up a little bit. We can do all of this through this like beautiful industry that we have of crafting buildings. I mean, it's hard for me, I'm biased, to think of an industry that can have that much impact across so many different parts of society, you know, individual people, families, communities, health, you know, I mean, just everything, right? So it's a really unique place to be in, time to be in, to be able to, you know, craft these buildings that deliver all of this stuff.
Mic drop. Yeah, man. I agree completely. Do you have final thoughts or was that a good final thought?
Ah, that might be it. I feel like I have to step down from my soapbox here. I was kind of pontificating there. But...
Yeah, soapboxes are okay. That's kind of what these are. And I also want you to know, listeners, you to know that, you know, I think I know Josh's headspace pretty well. I've talked to him pretty deeply for a long period of years here. There's a lot of humility in this man, right? If you have, you know, a reasonable, fact-based counter-argument to anything that was just said, I'm sure he'd be open to it. Yeah. You know, sort of my kind of culminating thought, like, so, you know, I have been really thinking, just like you, right? For whatever reason, I've ended up being this, like, lucky enough to be able to be thoughtful. You know, like you said earlier, right? Like I'm not hand to mouth with money. I can slow down and think about what do I want to do? What's meaningful to me? Where do I think this industry is going? How can I encourage this societal transition? And I don't have much doubt that society is going to electrify. It's just, it's an upgrade, right? It's what we've always done. We've upgraded our fuel sources from, you know, apparently we were the first primates to lift up rocks and eat those bugs that live under them with high fat content, and that grew our brain, right? So that was an energy source. And then we went from hunter-gatherer to agrarian and from agrarian to fossil fuel, and now we're going from fossil fuels to renewables. It's an inexorable transition in the same direction. Therefore, I have very little doubt that that is forward. you combine that with all of you and I and listeners, we know this very well, that forward is also a better enclosure filled with healthier air, more comfortable surroundings. It's an upgrade, right? And then my last kind of thought is, it's a little bit, I'm trying not to be negative, it is that rarely do the incumbent technologies, the people responsible for those, jump on board and try to help society move away from their products, right? It's just, that's also not logical. It's not happened very much. You know, the people that made carriages to be drawn by horses, did they say, hey, check out these cars. You guys should really check out these cars. No, it's just not the way the consumer society exists. So anyway, that resonated in me when you were speaking there.
I think that's great, and it's totally right. And it's for us to do the right thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well said. Well, Josh, it's been a pleasure. I thought it might be, and I was right. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. I've really appreciated the conversation. And like I said earlier, it's an honor to be on the podcast.
It's an honor to be honored. So thanks again, Josh. And thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you next time.